another 666 ABC Canberra podcast. To subscribe to any of our podcasts, go to abc.net.au/Canberra.
Today, my guest is a very distinguished Australian. Major General the Honourable Michael Jeffrey was Australia's 24th Governor General, the 27th Governor of Western Australia, and a decorated Australian soldier. General Jeffrey is currently the National Advocate for Soil Health. And when asked why a retired soldier and Governor General is passionate about the health of our soils, he answers that he is concerned about our future well-being, the future well-being of our children and grandchildren, and because he says to save the soil is to save the planet. Major General, the Honourable Michael Jeffrey, joins me this afternoon for a longer chat in Canberra Close-Up and to play some of his favourite music. How great to see you, General Jeffrey. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Alex. Always a pleasure to be here and to be interviewed by such a lovely interviewer as you.
Okay. We're happy in each other's company. That's nice. A nice start, isn't it? Look, before we get to two of your great, great passions, and that's soil health, and I love that, to save the soil is to save the planet, and the role of the Governor General in Australian life, this is a chance, A, to get you to choose music, which is always very telling, I think, people's choice of music, and to talk about what's formed you, your early influences. And speaking of soils, you were born in Wiluna in Western Australia. If we're speaking of fragile soils, you're a son of it.
Well, true, because Wiluna, when I was born there in 37, of course, was quite a big gold mining town, about 8,000 people. Now it's probably got about 250, mostly Aboriginals, who have a very good art gallery there, by the way. So I knew it only for 3 years because we then moved down to Perth at the start of the war. But I do remember the gold mining derricks, the long railway line.
So they're some of your earliest memories.
Yes. And the sunsets and the blueness of the sky. And my mum told me that I used to run away from home quite often at the age of two or three, and I'd always be picked up by the local butcher or somebody and put a sign on my back saying, "Does anybody know this boy? Please take him home," or words to that effect. So I had a spirit of adventure, I'm sure, from an early age.
I was looking it up on the map today, and with your smartphone technology, it zeroed in, and as you got closer and closer to Wiluna, the redness of the dirt, of the soil, came up. So that red dirt, blue sky.
Well, it's interesting. You can grow a lot of things there with water, and of course Aboriginal communities have had orange orchards and all sorts of things, and I guess we'll get onto it later on, but so much more of our landscape, I think, can be used if we do it intelligently.
Mm. Tell me about your parents. What were they doing in Wiluna to have young Michael?
Well, my mother was a nursing sister. Her parents had come from South Australia. My dad was a POM, and he left home after a very happy childhood. He was going to South Australia to go on a farm there, but he jumped ship at Fremantle, and then went up north into the Kimberley as a stockman, boundary rider and gold prospector, ended up in Wiluna as a gold assayer, and that's where he met my mother, and that's where I was born. And then at the beginning of the war, about 1940, Dad came down to Perth to join up, and the gold ran out, so we did not go back to Wiluna.
But that obviously tells a bit of a story about your father. That's quite a big risk to head into such a remote place as a young English fellow.
Well, I think that's been one of the big things about the Brits overall. I mean, in early days, the eldest son inherited the property. Number two went into the military. Three went into the priesthood. And four was told to go out and make his fortune. Well, Dad went out to make his he didn't make a fortune, of course, but he walked over all the iron ore fields of the Pilbara. But in those days, of course, you couldn't stake it, and he was always in trouble with his children for not persevering. Otherwise, he might have been the Reinhardt family equivalent or something like that.
You, how many children are you amongst?
Just three. I was the eldest of three, a sister and a brother.
Well, he went out to make his fortune, and he went out and made a future Governor General of Australia. So,
well,
it's not a bad achievement.
I think parental influence is very strong on families, and it's been one of my pet philosophies, I guess, right throughout my military and viceregal life, to say that the fundamental core of a healthy society is happy and functional families, you know, with a mum and dad and kids who grow up in a loving environment with a bit of discipline, but kids who know where the parameters are and are well looked after and get a good education and so on. And that's mum and dad's job to do that.
And they know, the kids know they're loved.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. You are on 666 and Major General, the Honourable Michael Jeffrey. General Jeffrey is my special guest this afternoon. So of your parents, who was the dominant influence on you, do you think, of those early years?
My dad, although he was not well educated in the conventional sense, he was probably one of the wisest men I ever knew, because he predicted the rise and the fall of Russia. He predicted the rise of China and so on. And we'd always have very good debates around the kitchen table at night time, always discuss everything. And Mum was the stirrer. She would throw a little bomb into the middle of the table, then watch all of us tearing each other apart, and then she'd just sit back with a little smile on her. But that's how we were encouraged to think and express
our views.
Aren't
they fantastic, those conversations?
Yes, they are. There should be more of it.
You are on 666. So that kind of spirited debate, strong personalities, obviously really early influences and very formative.
Yeah. And we had to suss things out. You know, if we didn't know something, we had to go and look up the dictionary to be able to speak as intelligently as we could, given our knowledge base. But I always thank our mum and dad for exciting that interest in the three of us.
Now, you've put a lot of thought into your music today, which I thank you for very, very much. What would you like me to play first out of the box for you?
Well, I think we better do Here's the Model of a Very... that's the start point.
Why not? Then do we need to explain anymore?
Something humorous.
Needs no explanation at all.
No, well, I've always been so proud of having been a soldier of the Australian Army, and I've been very proud to have been fortunate enough to make it to Major General, because during the course of my military life, I had the privilege of commanding most units from a 30-man platoon to a 15,000-man division, my linkage with my soldiers and officers and NCOs has always been very special, as has been with their families, their wives and spouses and the family side. So it's been a very important part of my life, of which I enjoyed every day.
And that song celebrates it all in the most beautiful way. The Major General, the Honourable Michael Jeffrey, is my guest this afternoon in Canberra Close Up. So as you said, because the war, Second World War came, you were born just before the start of the Second World War, so you moved to Perth. Yes. And what were your parents doing then? They were...
My mother was a nursing sister at the Wiluna Hospital, and Dad was a gold assayer. And in fact, it's a very interesting little story, because I think about when my mother was 88 or thereabouts, I took her back to Wiluna for the centenary of the Gazette of the town. And we visited the old hospital, which happened to be the local council buildings, and there was a great troop of people with us. And Mum was holding forth about everything, and they were all listening to her. They didn't take any notice of me. I just happened to be the governor. That was nothing. And we came past this little tin room, and she stopped, and she looked at it, and she turned to the whole multitude, and she said, "Michael, this was the birthing room. It was 110 degrees, and you were a very difficult birth, and you weren't a particularly good-looking baby." And I said, "Thank you very much, Mum." But that's they were the conditions.
110 degrees in a tin shed.
That's
gutsy, isn't it?
Yeah. They were great, great people, women who lived and worked in the outback in those days.
In what were you like at school? What was that those years like in Perth? Because of course you've got, you know, the World War II hanging over you. It must have been a huge influence on you.
Well, the main memories I have at school is that, firstly, I respected every one of the teachers I had. Didn't matter whether it was in primary school or high school, because they were, without exception, all of them very good. And it was about an even, maybe a slightly higher percentage of blokes, because they had come back from the war. But we respected them. They knew how to handle young people and young boys. And in those days, you got the cuts, you know, of 2 or 4 or something for being a bit naughty. But I can't ever recall feeling as though, you know, we were being put upon or assaulted or anything, because the same teacher who gave you 2 for being doing something stupid was the guy who took you out football training of the afternoon, or took you away on a fortnight's cadet camp, and etc. So I always found our teachers, and particularly those blokes who'd come back from the war, very good, and the women were not to be messed with either. They ran a class and they ran it well. They were good teachers, and so my experience of teaching profession in those days was one of a very positive one.
At just 16, you left home to come to the Royal Military College, Duntrew. That was in 1953.
55. Mm. Right, almost on my 17th birthday. I'm cheating a bit, but I was 16 when I left home, which is
so
very young.
Yeah.
Yes, well, it originally I was thinking of being a farmer, because I used to go down to a dairy beef farm in the southwest of Western Australia, Nanup, every year for holidays, and the couple there didn't have any children. And I think they wanted me to sort of take over the property. But then I joined the school cadets, and that was it. As soon as I got into the military business, that's all I ever wanted to do. And I'm very pleased I made that choice. Mm. So off to Duntrew we went.
What did you think that would lead to when you joined the school cadet and you said, OK, the army's for me? What did you think that would be, that kind of life?
I certainly didn't think of it in terms of promotion or being chief of the army or anything like that. What excited me was the sense of adventure, travel, operational service, weaponry, command, how to lead 30 men in the initial thing, and then 100, and then 700, and then 3,500, and then 15,000, then eventually titular commander-in-chief. So we went through the whole deal. But I can honestly say, other than trying to get the best report one could, because we were reported on annually in terms of our skill sets and so on, a very good system, it was the way of life and the moving every couple of years, and then operational service, Malaya, Borneo, Vietnam, PNG.
What was Canberra like in 1955?
25,000 people, a little iron shed and DC-3 aeroplanes, and a long train trip.
Yeah, it's a very long. What did you think when you got here?
Well, I mean, all that was here was the Parliament, departments of state. I think there was one cafe, the Blue Moon Cafe down in Civic. That was it. And a picture theatre, the Marnica Picture Theatre. As cadets, for the first year, we weren't allowed to wear civilian clothes, so we had to wear Blues uniform on leave, cycling our little bicycles. So you can imagine what that was like when the local boys got stuck amongst you and so on. So it was
targets.
You were targets. Oh, absolutely. Short back and sides, haircut, Blues uniform.
On your bike.
On your bike. And in those days, although I guess we had the same love of trying to find a girlfriend, the key was to find a mother of a girlfriend who could cook, because we were so hungry, you know. We, after breakfast, I'd stay behind and try and scrounge another couple of pieces of toast that you'd stick down your shirt and then cook it over your radiator when you got into your room. Because of the physical exercise we were doing.
Plus, you're still growing as boys,
we're
aren't
growing,
you?
That's right.
17, you still grow into your 20s. Yeah. So a bit of tension at the Blue Moon Cafe then.
Well, know. a bit of yes, and the picture theatre. There were no nightclubs or anything like that, picture theatre. And we didn't have any money. I think we were paid 2 shillings a day. Mm. So you couldn't take girlfriends out to anything expensive. So mostly you went out to their place or went to like a footy match if you weren't playing football yourself. Then maybe home for a Sunday roast dinner with
heaven.
Heaven.
General
apple
Jeffrey.
Pie and ice cream.
And he grew another 2 inches overnight. You are on 666. And, of course, when you talk footy, you're talking AFL because you're from Western Australia.
Yeah. Mm. Yes, well, I played in our Duntroon team. I wasn't particularly brilliant. I was a tall, skinny ruckman. But the problem for we cadets in those days is that we were playing as boys. We were playing fully developed men. And as a result, although we were fit, we got badly knocked around. And it would be surprising. I would have thought 50 or 60% of my class had knee replacements while they were cadets. Later that rule was changed and the cadets tend to play other schools and so on. But for the first year or two, it was pretty willing.
There's a few similarities with Angus Houston, isn't there? Because he was in the Muck and Boodin first 11, as I understand it.
Yeah.
A footy player, and that's where he got the name Angus, because his name's actually Alan. West Australian said, oh, no, not that. You're from Scotland, so you'll be called Angus.
Oh, well, the Air Force had it much more gentle than the Duntroon. We went through initiations and so on, which were very severe. But again, from our class's point of view, although we went through a very tough initiation, none of us have ever looked back on it as being anything abnormal, because what it did, first of all, you had to be able to stick it out. Secondly, it bound the class very close together. And as a result, my class, which, been around for 60 years, we still link up 3, 4, 5 times a year. And when the boys drop off the perch, we look after the girls. So that initiation, et cetera, was a catalyst for welding our class into the terrific bunch of blokes that, and girls that it is.
You are on 666, and Major General the Honourable Michael Jeffrey is my guest in Canberra Close-Up this afternoon. Before we go to news headlines, another bit of music.
Absolutely.
General Jeffrey, what would you like me to play?
Well, I think we'll do The Messiah, will we? Just for a bit different. Is that
why not?
Why not?
One of the great music choices.
Well, it's a very special one for me, because firstly, I'm quite happy to say very openly that I've got a pretty strong faith, as has my wife and hopefully the kids. But there's a very true statement that there's very few atheists in a foxhole. And when the chips are really down, from my experience, people do tend to think and talk up there, particularly if they feel their lives are at risk, etc. And you can see it in great national disasters, etc. People tend then to go back to that fundamental belief. And again, when men are dying, and they generally call out to their mothers or their wives and their God. That just happens that way. And I think sometimes that we run great risks when we degrade the spiritual dimension. And I think that is part of the problem that society is facing now, particularly young people, because if you've got nothing to hold on to other than the material, that can be a bit weakening, I think, in terms of social development. And whilst I don't have any problem with parents saying, well, I'm not religious or I don't go to church, I think the big mistake is if you do not allow your children to experience the opportunity so that they can make their own decisions, because many of them would probably say, yes, I do want to follow up more on a spiritual side, because it impacts on me, and that's the big thing.
One, as you talked about, those fantastic round the table conversations, that is a great one to have as a family, and as you say, with your children, to allow them to go forth and make their decisions on that.
Yeah.
And you are with Alex Sloan this afternoon. And my very special guest in Canberra Close-Up, Major General the Honourable Michael Jeffrey, is my guest. And we're having a great conversation. We got to faith and his deep faith. And you mentioned before, of course, operational service in Malaya, then with Borneo. That was with the British, actually, wasn't it?
I was seconded to the British Special Air Service, which was a fascinating experience during Confrontasi, it was as it was called, and then that was when the SAS was sneaking across the border to see what the other side were doing. But it was very good preparation for our army when Vietnam followed on, and I went to Vietnam as a infantry company commander.
Before you went on operational service in Vietnam, you married Marlena Kerr. Of Manly,
absolutely.
I noticed. Four children and one grandchild later, a long and happy marriage. What's the secret to that long and happy marriage?
Well, it's 10 grandchildren.
Yes.
You've reduced
this
by nine.
I'm really getting behind in my research.
Well, I think the first thing is you've got to love each other and like each other, and you've got to give each other space. And you've got to be, there's got to be give and take, because people are all different. And I think over the 49 years we've been married, we've learned to do that pretty well. But the thing is, too, that you've got to operate as a team. And right through my military career and vice regal career, Marlene has had such important roles of looking after military families and then supporting me in the as Governor of Western Australia and Governor General, and that role is so important. You can't do it by yourself, or it's much harder if you're in that situation. So, and she's been a wonderful mum, and now she's a very, very doting
On the 10 grandchildren.
Yeah, on the second round.
And Marlena, I should have said, not Marlena. Yeah. General Jeffrey, you were awarded the Military Cross and the South Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry. And I suppose with the recent 50th anniversary of the Battle of Long Tan, we've all been thinking deeply about our involvement, Australia's involvement in that conflict and its lasting impact on those who served. Mm. What are your thoughts 50 years later?
Well, I've always, and I've said this publicly and I've said it to my soldiers on scores of occasions, I always believed in our being involved in Vietnam, because you've got to look at the total historical context of what was happening around the world, because just after World War II finished, you had the start of the Cold War, you had the Berlin airlift in 1948, you had the start of the Malayan Emergency, which went for 12, 14 years, you had the Korean War in 1951, you had the Indochina War. All those things were happening at the same time and posing a very big threat. Indeed, that's why the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization was set up, so that when North Vietnam invaded the South against the Geneva Conventions, and the Americans decided to go in, and Australia decided to participate, I thought that was the right thing to do. We got beaten in a campaign sense for all sorts of reasons. But what it did do, I think, was provide the breathing space for countries like Malaya, Thailand in particular, to tread down the Western democracy path. And it also, I think, prevented the potential invasion of Laos and Cambodia by North Vietnam if they hadn't had to fight the war in the South. I think Vietnam would have probably tried to develop into the greater Indochina, and that wouldn't have been a good thing at the time. So I've always said to my diggers, and we had 50 of them at lunch the other day in our house, that they should be proud of their service. They are wonderful soldiers. They did their country proud, and I think helped to bring about stability in certainly in a regional sense, even though we lost the war.
Your experience as a soldier and you got to the top, and you're leading so many of those personnel. What do you? How has it left you? What that experience?
Oh, a great love of my soldiers and of the profession, because the military art is the most, I think, the most complex of them all. Because if you're running a battle, etc., it involves everything: logistics, medical, planning, tactics, leadership, weapons, coordination of fire, you name it. And you've got to, at the tactical level, you've got to be thinking these things through very fast. You've got to make decisions, correct decisions, with a minimum loss of life and casualties. And that's what your soldiers expect of you. They expect their officers to be good leaders, to be able to think clearly, give orders clearly, to be held accountable for their actions, and to win the battle with a minimum loss of life. Soldiers, from my experience, don't want to be mates with their officers. You have a drink with your officer and so on, your platoon commander, but officers shouldn't be mates per se with their soldiers, because the officer sometimes has to make very tough decisions, and you've got to, I think, having the respect of your soldiers and the regard of them is are the key things. Rather, and perhaps sometimes that develops into a love of soldiers for a commander, because that commander has particular attributes.
You, General Jeffrey, is my guest this afternoon. You became the governor of your home state, Western Australia, in 1993, and then our 24th Governor General in 2003, and you were sworn into this role as a steadying hand after the resignation of Peter Hollingsworth. Do we Australians look to someone from defence to create stability, do you think?
Well, I think, I mean, I don't want to be pedantic about this, but I think the military, by and large, have skill sets that suit that particular role. For a start, you're non-partisan in a political sense, because the military has to be. Secondly, you understand the ceremonial sense. Thirdly, hopefully you can speak with everyone in the society. You understand something of the law, because you've probably been president of courts martial and so on, which are legal courts of law. And hopefully your integrity is without question. So they, I think, are reasonable attributes for that particular function.
You, as a former Governor General, you feel the role is misunderstood, and particularly by the media. What would you like us to understand?
Well, I think it goes back to the fundamentals of this whole country, better understanding how we are governed. You know, the whole system of governance, where the function of the role of the governor, the crown, the governor general, and the relationship of the governor general to the prime minister and the executive and so on. Understanding something of the constitution. And one of the things I'm trying to do as chairman of the Constitutional Education Fund of Australia is to get programs into the schools and mock parliaments into the schools, so that every youngster grows up with an understanding and appreciation of the importance of the democracy. But when it comes to the role of the Governor-General, I think probably there wouldn't be one in a thousand who really understand it. It's nobody's fault. It's just the way it is. But I've always believed that our monarchical democratic system of government has suited us very well. But I've always said that if people can dream up better ways in which to govern ourselves, then we should look at that and debate it. But only change if you understand that the checks and balances will be at least the equivalent of what we have now.
The Republican debate in this country ebbs and flows, and many feel that while Queen Elizabeth reigns, we will not see any real momentum to become a republic. Do you agree?
Well, I think that's absolutely so. And then I think we've really got to sit down. If people are going for a republic out of straight emotion, you know, we're going to elect an Australian head of state, and therefore the country's going to be terrific, we're going to feel more proud of it, I think that's rubbish by and large. I think it's a fair debate to say, should we change to a republic? But then we've got to do that. You've got to understand how your current system works. and what its real checks and why have we been a stable democracy for over 100 years? It's not because we've had nice prime ministers, although we've had a number of them. It's because of the checks and balance inherent in our current system. And if you're going to change it, including the method of appointing or electing a future president or a governor general, if you're going to keep that name, you've got to be very careful that you...
When you say stability of the system, many people would come back and say, well, 1975 was a case in point of being not stable, of Australians not understanding when a Governor-General can come in and sack a Prime Minister.
Well, you've got to look at the laws of the land. The laws of the land are very simple, that if a Prime Minister is defeated in the lower house on a major bill, if a Prime Minister and a government cannot get supply, if a Prime Minister acts in an unconstitutional manner or is a crook, then his commission can be terminated. And that's part of the reserve power set up. And it's only been used twice, 75 with Mr Whitlam and 32, I think, with Governor Game and Jack Lang in New South Wales for much the same reason. So the legality of that, taking that decision, was right and proper. Perhaps the method of execution or implementation could have been done in a different way.
But your, I suppose, take-home message is there, understand how the role works at the moment before you throw it out for something that you don't understand.
Yes, because then you could get yourself into deep trouble.
I want to leave time for soils. Well, we'll go to a little bit more music. We might be able to play it all the way through. General Jeffrey, which one would you like me to play?
Well, if we're going to talk soils, we better do Sunburned Country, I think.
And this is sung, the Dorothy McKellar poem.
Dorothy McKellar poem, yeah.
Song, mm. Sung. Getting a little bit teary, actually, General Jeffrey.
Well, you're a country girl.
I think so. General Jeffrey, we're going to talk about your role as the National Soils
Advocate.
And I've just been reading Tim Winton's quite marvellous book, The Boy Behind the Curtain. And, in fact, Tim's going to join me tomorrow, fellow Western Australian.
Yes.
And he's got a chapter which is called, I'll just pull that down, Repatriation. I just want to read you a little bit. And he says, today, a late autumn day in 2008, as I drive from Perth towards the old pastoral lease of Mount Gibson Station, a wicked easterly howls in off the desert and the sky is pink with dirt. Less than a century ago, this bit of country was a series of eucalypt woodlands of remarkable biodiversity, but it was bulldozed and burned at the urging of successive governments to make way for cultivation. The ancient soil, exposed by all this tree grubbing, was quickly depleted, and then it was laced with billions of tons of superphosphate, which lured two generations of farmers into the delusion that their operations were sustainable. Emboldened by good seasons and high prices, grain farmers pushed right out into the drylands. At the time, it must have seemed that nature itself was surrendering to a human ingenuity and the vigour of a new settler culture. I remember driving through wheat country on winter's nights as a boy to see mile upon mile of burning windrows whose parallel lines were the column were like a column of an army on the march. Back then, the son of wheat farmers believed they would inherit something precious. This was before the creeping insurgency of salt and the arrival of almost permanent drought. Farmers have been walking off the land here for more than a decade, and those who hung on to their scorched earth inheritance are given incentives to plant the very trees their fathers were paid to grub up. For many, it's probably too little too late.
Well, I gave that book to my wife as a birthday present.
It's the book of the year for me. This is the book of the year.
But that was very, I think, pungently told. And I mean, today we do have soil and water problems in Australia. That's recognised, but it's pleasing to see that farmers are now starting to come to grips with this, because in my view, how we treat the top 30 centimetres of our soil, its microbial, fungal function, etc., is key to planetary survival. And everything comes from the soil, doesn't it? Our food, our fibre, a lot of our energy, and our clean water, because rain, etc., is supposed to be filtered through the soils. So we've got to look after it, and it's not just the soil by itself, because the soil can only function properly if you've got the hydrology right. That is, if the water's moving in the soil. To do that, every drop of rain that falls on the landscape, we want to get it into the soil, whereas 50% of our rainfall is evaporating. Half of it, 25 times the quantity of all the water in our dams, each year is evaporating when it shouldn't be in the soil. You think of the difference that would make to soil health and so on if we could fix that. And the third ingredient, of course, is what you're growing. And what we have to do in this country is to ensure that every square inch of landscape that we can, even in the tops of big buildings, is covered in some sort of green, grasses or rose bushes or... But it's got to be mixtures, biodiversity, because it's that biodiversity of plants that then allows the water to filter into the soil, and then the water goes back up through the plants into the atmosphere to create that small water cycle and give us more consistent rain and so on. So all that's got to be done, and that's what we're trying to do as the soil advocate, to get that message across. And the big thing that I want to do is to establish or roll out from 21 leading practice agricultural sites that I've got, mainly in the southeast of Australia because of our economics at the time. But I want to roll out 100 of these case studies right round Australia of leading farmers who've corrected the imbalances in their soil management and water management to become economically, socially and environmentally viable.
Because I was talking actually to Vince Heffernan, who just won a produce award at the Delicious Awards, and he's a biodynamic farmer and he's all about soil and planting trees, and he's saying, you know, things like having rare and endangered species on his property mean the world to him. And you talk in your paper about the fact that these small number of farmers can't be the only ones carrying this burden for the rest of us, don't you?
Well, it's what we've got is about 120,000 farmers, 90-odd percent of family farms, and we've got, what, 24, 25 million people. Now, in my view, firstly, those 120,000 farmers should be paid a fair price for their product. It's ridiculous if it costs 40 cents for a litre of milk that the farmer gets 39 or 42, and somehow the middlemen and the big... And the public will pay what when they know what a fair price is, because we have to, don't we?
Well, you've seen quite a flip on milk, actually, at the moment. Once we got an understanding of what was going on for the farmers.
Well, that's exactly right. But the second thing, I think, is our urban Australia have to reward farmers for looking after 60% of this continent on their behalf. And that might be in helping them, support them if they want to repair a wetland or a riparian zone or put trees on the ridges or whatever it might be. And I think if that is explained clearly to the public, then they'd be prepared to do that.
Because you would call for a kind of a system to support farmers and landholders who you see as stewards, so perhaps a stewardship payment? Is that how would that work?
Well, I think the WizKids could work all that. There's a thousand different ways. Okay. All I'm saying is that it is wrong for 120,000 farmers to carry the debt burden of looking after what is our most valuable asset. And if I had my way, I'd be looking at our soil, our water and our plants as key national natural strategic assets to be managed accordingly and to be managed in an integrated way. And I'd get government to legislate on that so we lift the whole dimension of how we look at it. And the other thing is that's very important, I think, is to do as Stephanie Alexander and others are doing, is put a garden in every primary and junior high school in the country, but with a graduated syllabus that takes the kids through some knowledge of the soil and its function and water and everything. So they're taught not just to grow a healthy tomato and carrot, but they're taught how that happens, etc. Then we'd get an informed public. Then we'd get our farmers better supported. Then we get more kids into ag science and onto the land.
Does it surprise many people? You were put into this role by the then Prime Minister Julia Gillard in 2012. Does it surprise many people that you are in this role?
Well, I think it does, you know, because I don't have any academic qualifications in that. But by gee, I can tell you, in the last 3 years, I've learnt a lot, and I must have spoken with 4,000 or 5,000 farmers and all the scientists and the chief scientists and the ag colleges and the rural leaders And I think we've now got a pretty good strategy, which I intend to give to the government and the Prime Minister as the National Soil Advocate to, first of all, to get our research base, which is the 100 case studies, long-term research base, get a national policy to look after our Australian landscape, and to get the gardens into the schools and to refocus our, get our science focused properly.
So you gave a terrific paper at the 2016 National Landcare Conference. Is that up online? It's a terrific paper.
Is it? Well, I better check out that
very
it is.
Yeah. Clearly, yeah. I got it.
Yeah, did you?
But I thought this is. Yeah. I'm with you, yeah. General Jeffrey.
Thank you very much
on this. You're doing a tremendous job. You said, can we get a bit of Pavarotti in before we go? Is there any reason for?
Only that Marlene and I met him in Melbourne at a concert and. He was a very big man in those days, and he didn't move much, and he ate a lot at his dinner afterwards. But the sheer magic of his voice just inspires me every time.
È sempre misero chi a lei s'affida, chi le confida.
To meet Pavarotti. And not to be had for lunch or for dinner.
No. I wouldn't like to compete with him.
Major General, the Honourable Michael Jeffrey is my guest in Canberra Close Up this afternoon. So this is the soil message is a huge passion for you.
Yes, I want to become a huge passion for it, that if you eat, you should be involved. And that simple message to save the planet, we must save the soil. That's got to be the driving thing. And when you look what's happening in the Middle East, the deserted, you know, Turkey's got 40 or 50 years of topsoil left. Rivers in China polluted. Mekong being dammed and they're heading into Tibet. Soil losing arable land probably at the rate of 1% per year, and yet we've got to go from 7 to 10 billion population in the next 30 years. These are the issues of real fundamental importance.
Does it strike you as the boy who was born in the tin shed and 110 degree in Wooloona has kind of come full circle with this in a way? Or
I never look at it that way. I just look upon it of having been extremely privileged and never ever bored for a second. It's been hard at times, but still is very busy. But I really believe the fundamentals of life that once, if you've got your family, once you've looked after your family, you know, with a job and income and so on, you looked after them. Then, if you can do something for your street or your neighbourhood or your city or your state or your country, then that's the most rewarding service of all.
Well, all strength to you, particularly on the soils, and so lovely that you spent the time with us today, General Jeffrey. My thanks and happy birthday to Marlena. You've given her a very good birthday present. Repatriation is the chapter I would love you to read. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for listening to this 666 ABC Canberra podcast. To subscribe to this or any of our podcasts, go to abc.net.au/Canberra.